This is Justin Gibson.
And this is Luke Ramsey. You're listening to Tributaries, where we examine how science and history flow into each other and shape our world.
In this episode, we're taking you back to September of 1878 to learn what it was like to live in Memphis during one of the worst disease outbreaks in history.
Due to its important role in shipping, the Civil War left Memphis largely undisturbed, at least compared to many other southern cities.
This is Taylor Hopkins, the director of Mallory Neely and McGivney Houses.
Memphis was a booming port town. You had a lot of different prominent families moving to Memphis to expand their businesses, coming in from the East Coast, up north, and they were coming here to settle down. While also, on the other hand, you had a lot of people moving to Memphis with nothing but the clothes on their back, kind of following their dreams, hoping to make it big.
But the city had not entirely escaped tragedy. In the 1870s, Memphis faced a new threat, yellow fever.
This is Kim Bearden, executive director of Elmwood Cemetery.
Right about the time of the yellow fever epidemics, you know, there were about 50,000 people in the city of Memphis, which, you know, that doesn't sound like very many, but it was bigger than Nashville.
But in a few months in the fall of 1878, that number plummeted below 10,000, leaving the city forever changed.
Throughout the 1870s, there were multiple outbreaks of yellow fever in Memphis, usually coming to a peak in the late summer and early fall. The worst of these came in 1878.
And yellow fever was no stranger to the region, and Memphians were already familiar with the symptoms from outbreaks in 1828, 1855, 1867, and again in 1873, when 2,000 lives were claimed.
It was described like this in Dr. Drumgoole's Heroes, Honors, and Horrors of 1878.
The onset is more apt to be sudden and violent than that of the fevers which prevail here, and more apt to occur at night. Frequently, but not invariably, a chill precedes the fever. There is violent pain in the forehead at the beginning, soon followed by severe pain in the lower part of the back. The eyes are red and glistening.
The victims of the fever would develop a high temperature, chills, nausea, and aches all over. Sometimes the fever would stop there, abating after several days. However, for many victims, it would return, bringing with it bloody black vomit, the telltale signs of their eyes and skin turning yellow, and often death.
News made it to Memphis that yellow fever had appeared in New Orleans in the summer of 1878, and the city officials responded by creating a quarantine, banning travel to and from New Orleans into the lower Mississippi.
Checkpoints were set up on roads, and docks and harbors were closed, but the measures taken did not go far enough.
And when downtown restaurant owner Kate Bionda came down with yellow fever, it caused a panic throughout the city. With the memory of the 1873 outbreak fresh in their minds, Memphians began to flee the city in huge numbers.
In the coming weeks, over 25,000 Memphians, around half the entire population, fled the city.
When news of the fever broke in Memphis that it was coming up from New Orleans, and then when it was finally released that it had landed in Memphis, a great many people fled from the city. And it's, you can't really blame them for doing that, because it was considered a stranger's disease, which means that if you had not been acclimated to it, or if you had not been exposed to it before, you were going to have a rough go of it, and chances are your children were going to die, you could die. So it's, you know, a lot of those immigrants who had, you know, populated Memphis in the earlier days packed up and headed out of town. They headed up north to places like St. Louis and Cincinnati. And once they established themselves there, they did not come back home.
Roads to Nashville and Little Rock were clogged, and as the quarantined region grew, many refugees had to resort to setting up tent cities on the outskirts rather than leaving.
Of the 25,000 people that remained, over 17,000 were infected with the disease between August and October, with an average of over 200 people dying each day during the disease's peak.
But the people who stayed here tried to stay away from one another, much like you're seeing with the COVID response now, because they did not know how the disease was transmitted. There was a great deal of rationing that took place. The food and supplies that were brought into Memphis from the government came in via train. And, you know, the city largely survived on bacon and coffee for many weeks, because those were the supplies that could make it in. Medical supplies were short. You know, it was a not unlike we're experiencing now with some household goods, and some food items. Some meat processing plants are beginning to close nationally now, and so that is sort of, on a larger scale, what Memphis would have experienced at that time.
For those who remained in the city of Memphis, they were under strict quarantine rules. Everything was shut down. Only essential employees were allowed out of their homes. There was a shortage of food and other daily life essentials. And families stuck together at this time and prayed that no one in their house would catch the fever, because hospitals and things like that weren't nearly as prevalent as they are today. So if you caught fever, you were more than likely stuck in your house, slowly dying.
Memphis Daily Appeal on August 21st, 1878 read,
"Strong men and women and little children are sick and dying. The dead, dying and sick, are in the same house, often in the same room, presenting a pitiful sight, well calculated to affect the heart of the most callous. Many of the poor people who are stricken are suffering for supplies and necessary attention. These dreadful sights are not soon to be erased from memory."
People were dying faster than graves could be dug, leading to the creation of mass graves in local cemeteries.
Elmwood was one of the cemeteries that served anybody in Memphis, largely served the Protestant community, but was open to all, and it was also an integrated cemetery. And so many people came to rest here, including, and that includes a large area in the cemetery that we call No Man's Land, made up of four public lots where people were buried in the 1878 epidemic. There are over 1,400 victims buried there.
And since the medical community did not know how the disease spread, it seemed all the more menacing.
Memphians tried burning the clothes and linens of the deceased, and even burning tar in the street to ward off bad air. As noted in the public ledger of Memphis on September 27, 1873,
"Instantly upon the appearance of yellow fever, prompt and efficient means should be taken to purify every square foot of the city, so that the contagion may have no friendly influences in its favor, in either air, water, or earth. Every case should be cut off from the remainder of the city by the fumes of carbolic acid, chlorine, or sulfurous gas. The dead bodies of persons dying of yellow fever should be washed with dilute carbolic acid as promptly after death as possible."
But none of this worked, and the city began to shut down more and more.
As the city locked down, not everyone was running away. Some citizens stepped up to treat the sick and dying.
The yellow armband on exhibit at the museum was used to boldly identify one group of individuals who stepped up to volunteer.
So the Howard Associations were different volunteer organizations that kind of started popping up all over the United States. You had one in New Orleans, one in Philadelphia, places of major outbreaks. And they were these volunteer groups that were supported by local businessmen and benefactors that were created to help aid cities during major epidemics such as yellow fever. So in Memphis during the yellow fever outbreak, the Howard Association would send out teams of people who would be nicknamed visitors, who would go door to door and evaluate the situation of every home. They were there to discover if someone in the household had contracted the fever, in which case they would then alert the association doctors and nurses so that they could be treated in home. They also helped in delivering food, medicine, and other supplies to those in need. And they were easily identifiable because of the quarantine rules by these yellow armbands that they would wear that would say either HA or Howard Association on them.
And certain brave physicians and clergy actually came to Memphis to help treat victims and fight the spread of the feared disease.
So originally, the Four Sisters of St. Mary, you had Constance, Thecla, Huetta, and Frances. They were sent to Memphis to establish an orphanage and school before the 1873 outbreak. They are considered so important because not only did they assist those in need in the 1873 epidemic, but they saved countless lives in the 1878 fever as well. When the outbreak began in 1878, Constance and one of the other sisters had actually been up in New York traveling, but returned immediately when they heard what was happening. And the sights that they came across during that time Constance actually wrote about in letters to her mother's superior back in New York, who she just left, saying that they were burning the bed sheets of those who had died in the streets. Chaos had ensued the city. And what ends up happening is her and the sisters start going door to door to find those who needed medical assistance, and they helped nurse the ill. They also held soup kitchens. They were in charge of a new orphanage for children whose families died due to the fever. Unfortunately for them, like most who stayed and helped, they would all pass away from the yellow fever themselves.
For reasons unknown at the time, Black Memphians suffered a much lower death rate from the disease.
Some think this was due to many generations of their ancestors' exposure to yellow fever in Africa, where the disease is believed to have originated around 5,000 years ago.
Because of their apparent resistance to the disease, the city turned to African Americans to join the police force, which had dropped from 41 officers to only 7.
This was the first time that the Memphis police force hired Black officers, and many remained on the force until codified segregation in 1895.
This coincided with the rise of a major figure in Memphis's African American community, Robert R. Church.
Well, Robert Church was the South's first Black millionaire, but his father was a white steamboat captain, and his mother was an enslaved person. And they had an affair, and Robert was born. He was born into slavery, but he was not quite a slave. He lived in this gray area where his father didn't fully acknowledge him, but doted on him and gave him what he needed, instructing him. He gave him a paid job on his steamboat. Robert's mother died when he was about 12 or 13 years old, and so he basically became his father's responsibility. And his father took it on. Robert saved money over the years and began investing in real estate downtown. As he did that, he was able to open up businesses downtown. Businesses that, you know, were saloons, but also the income from those places also supported, you know, places like Bill Street Baptist Church and ultimately Church's Auditorium, which was one of the few places African Americans could congregate in large numbers in the South before the turn of the century. When the 1878 epidemic hit, Memphis lost so many members of its community, so much of the population left, that it lost its status as a city because there were not enough taxes coming in to support the running of the city. And so after the fever passed, Robert Church was one of the first businessmen in town to step up and buy city bonds, which the city was offering to sell at sale, so that they could help build up some capital to begin the city services again. So we refer to him as one of the heroes of the yellow fever epidemic, and he is buried here at Elmwood.
And sometimes help came from unexpected places.
Heroes that you would have expected to stay were not the heroes who were, in fact, the ones who stayed. So, for instance, you had what they called sporting men or gamblers, and prostitutes or madams stayed behind and turned the places that they ran or owned into makeshift hospitals.
Annie Cook, while that isn't her real name, it's the name she chose when she came to Memphis and started a brothel downtown. She eventually became the owner of Mansion House, which was one of the top brothels, but when yellow fever hit in 1873, Annie shut it down, dismissed her ladies, and set it up at the hospital to single-handedly care for victims in 1873. She would reopen after the epidemic, continue her very successful business, all the way up until 1878, where this time she trained some of her ladies to be nurses when the fever hit. They would end up saving countless lives, but just like the Sisters of St. Mary, Annie Cook would contract the fever and pass away. However, she is actually remembered not for what she did before the epidemics, but for her kindness. She is often remembered as being called the 19th century Mary Magdalene.
Despite these valiant efforts, yellow fever raged throughout the city, eventually claiming over 5,000 lives.
For perspective, We're writing this episode in April of 2020, as the entire nation is shutting down due to the COVID-19 outbreak. At this point, the death toll across the United States of America has climbed over 52,000.
In just 1 month in 1878, yellow fever claimed nearly 5,000 lives in Memphis alone, and 20,000 throughout the region.
The terrifying disease kept the city in its grip until the first frost, after which the rate of infection dropped sharply.
While yellow fever had been halted for the time being, it left an irrevocable mark on the city of Memphis.
I think it changed Memphis forever. Yellow fever affected modern-day Memphis much more than the Civil War did. Yellow fever is the thing that changed the kind of person who lived in Memphis. So pre-yellow fever, you have some, you know, a lot of people who are immigrants who come and live in Memphis and have the attitude that they've moved into this country to make their money and their mark on the world and become successful. That's why they came here. And so they wrote, these were the people who were hardworking, cosmopolitan people. You know, they loved the arts. They loved art. They loved music. After yellow fever hit, because those people left Memphis, Memphis was largely empty for quite a while. So you see people coming in who were very religious, who didn't have the same sort of tastes as the people who left the city of Memphis. And so Memphis became a different kind of place to live. We developed into a largely medical society. There's a lot of medicine in Memphis, a lot of hospitals. St. Jude is here. Methodist Le Bonheur is huge. So we have a lot of medical, a lot of people in the medical field who live here, but also we have a lot of religious people who live here. And the arts have always sort of struggled in Memphis. I think it's because of that.
Yellow fever forever shaped not only Memphis, but also the world.
In the next episode, we'll talk about Memphians, the medical community, and how the American government responded to the devastating yellow fever outbreaks of the 1870s.
We'll dive into the science behind the disease and how that connects to disease outbreaks today.
But in the meantime, we urge you to check out the amazing information that Taylor and Kim have available on yellow fever and Memphis history.
Elmwood Cemetery is as much of a functioning cemetery as it is an outdoor museum. And we like to celebrate all of that. The richest and poorest people from all over the world, from all walks of life, are all represented here at Elmwood Cemetery. And that makes it a place filled with storytelling.
And if you are looking for more information, over at memphismuseums.org/museums-to-go, we are doing a closer look on the yellow fever epidemic, breaking it up into different categories that give you just more information and more perspective on people's lives during that time period. So make sure to check it out.
You've been listening to Tributaries from Museum to Go. I'm Luke Ramsey.
And I'm Justin Gibson. Thanks for listening.